Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with former Missouri Governor Jay Nixon, a Democratic governor who found much success at collaborating across the aisle in a largely red state. He's now a visiting senior fellow at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, where he's been sharing his views on how we deal with health policy moving forward in this current hyper-partisan reality we're living in. Lori Robertson also checks in, managing editor of FactCheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with former Missouri Governor Jay Nixon here on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with former Governor Jay Nixon, the 55th governor of the state of Missouri, who recently completed two terms in office. He's also served as the state's attorney general and as Missouri's state senator before that. Governor Nixon is a visiting senior leadership fellow at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and has joined the Dowd Bennett Law Firm in St. Louis. Governor Nixon, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you very much, and thanks for covering this important topic in a thoughtful way, the way that you all do.
You know, you recently addressed the Harvard School of Public Health on strategies to address the hyper-partisanship in American politics, and you've really focused in around the issue of health policy. And, you know, it's almost 10 years after the passage of the Affordable Care Act, and the legal and political challenges remain as divisive as ever. And meanwhile, Medicare for All is becoming the dominant theme in the 2020 Democratic presidential primary. And I wonder if you could give our listeners your current assessment of the health policy debate and how the partisan divide is impacting us.
First of all, healthcare is complicated, but the politics around it is not. That's one of the most frustrating parts here. You take very personal yet significant issue like healthcare, and when it gets ground down to simplicities of talking points and wedge issues, you get past the needs and the cares. I mean, the bottom line is, what's the old saying? Any donkey can kick a barn down. It takes a carpenter to build one. So what's missing, I think, is thoughtful, specific solutions about how progress can be made, not just in Congress, but in many other ways. And so I think broadening that healthcare debate to include wellness, to include other issues around this, I think is important. But the partisan divide right now is making it darn near impossible to get rational discussion without somebody attacking it just a few moments or a few sound bites later. So right now, while I deeply appreciate the candidates talking about healthcare and coming up with specific ideas, as we head into 2020, I'm not overly optimistic that the election process itself is going to yield any new specific insights.
Well, Governor Nixon, as a successful Democrat in a largely red state, I think we consider you a real expert on compromise. And we really recently welcomed Governors John Hickenlooper of Colorado and also Bill Weld of Massachusetts to our show. And what they had in common was a similar success at reaching across the aisle to build consensus on some pretty major contentious issues. We would love for you to share some of the strategies that you successfully used to bridge the political divide in Missouri, and we ask you to do that really so others might learn and benefit from them.
Well, first of all, I always use the word cooperate instead of compromise. I always felt like when I was asking somebody to work on something, if I told them to, would they be willing to compromise, that was a kind of a tone and a way to frame issues that made them defensive. Mm-hmm. What did they have to give up, right, in essence? And what we were really looking for is to move forward. So all I would usually ask folks is to cooperate. And if you can get them in the room and get them in the discussion, then good things can happen. You got to focus on the issues, not the partisanship, especially after being a governor in a state with two-thirds of both the House and the Senate, the opposite party, focusing on the issues. I mean, when people would walk up to me and say, I'm a Democrat or I'm a Republican, they were getting ready to say no. They weren't getting ready to say yes. Uh-huh. And consequently, staying away as much as you can from partisanship. There's also some gateways into this discussion that I think are easier gateways to get to the broader discussion than others that are in the issue area. Let me give you two examples. Mental health, and specifically then in the developmental disabilities area. Areas where, you know, the challenges that are there are real. They're not partisan challenges. For example, one of the programs that we put together that's been highly successful is a thing called Partnership for Hope. We found that folks with developmental disabilities, once they got beyond high school age, they were actually degrading because there wasn't as much socialization
That's
or help
right.
around them.
Right.
We put together a program to have those folks continue to get help, continue to get training, and also to give their parents or other caregivers some time off. And we found broad support throughout the state. Another thing that I always said was it was better to talk. If you had a difference with somebody, it was better to go to their house and talk about it. So consequently, I spent a fair amount of time when I was in office going to communities. If there was a leader there that I was disagreeing with on something, we'd sit down in their area and not make them come to the mountain. People are oftentimes more confident and comfortable in their own home areas, and especially if you can have people around them that they know. And the other thing is you got to stay positive. You know, if you're in elective office or appointed office, you're not going to succeed at everything you want to do, but the people that succeed are the ones that, you know, what's they say, leadership is to appear to know where you're going and be having a good time doing it. So I think staying positive is really, really important. And these days, especially in the political area, folks gravitate towards division and negative very, very quickly. And I know it's hard. It's hard not to lower, in essence, the tone. And it takes a long time to get people used to your voice and your strategy. But I found over the long haul, people would listen to me more if I was talking about what we could do instead of giving excuses for why we couldn't do something.
Well, one of the things that you wanted to do was clearly early in your term was to pass a measure requiring coverage for all Missouri children on the autism spectrum to be given access to treatment. And I guess it initially ran into some strong opposition, but it looked like the strategy that you just laid out for us prevailed. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that measure. And it sounds like you employed this optimistic strategy that met people where they were at, sort of their own home community. And what other successes like that were you able to achieve in moving policy? A really formidable opposition. 2/3 of both houses are in the hands of the other party.
Yeah, one of the records I have is over 270 substantive vetoes of substantive legislation that I did, that I held those vetoes, I sustained those vetoes. That's a lot of times where I had to veto bills and then go out and talk to folks about why what they were doing was the wrong policy and we needed to work together to alter that. So I was constantly working in those areas. But back to autism for a second, I think for me it was one of those teaching moments. I used to get up every morning and write when I was governor, and this was one where I had a discussion with myself because in my first year I really wanted to push autism coverage through insurance for all Missouri families. Got a vote in the Senate, overwhelming, 25-6 or something like that, just couldn't get it through the House in those final days. And a lot of the folks around there were saying, you know, you should attack the Speaker of the House and criticize them. There were going to be another year with kids not getting that coverage. And I should note this morning about 4,000 young folks, very young, were involved in that ABA treatment to turn their lives around because of us coming together and getting that done. But the bottom line was, I learned and knew that the Speaker of the House had had some family that had some challenges in the autism spectrum. So instead of, like, attacking him, we went down to his district, we went to Autism Center, had yet another hearing and discussion, invited him to be there. The bottom line is, in the first few months of the next session, that bill passed overwhelmingly. I think that was a good example of how I held a little of my fire. I may have gained something politically for dividing there, but we actually got it done. I think a couple other areas where we're really able to bring people together was in keeping the cost of college down. I mean, you're seeing all the discussion nationwide. I mean, Missouri was number one in the country at keeping tuition to four-year colleges down, and we didn't do that just by cutting their budgets. We invested in the colleges, and we worked directly with them. Consequently, in my 8 years, we were able to up the number of four-year public college degrees by 36%, which is a lot, and we were able to up those two-year degrees by 44%. That requires a lot of effort by a whole lot of people. And for me, that was one of the examples of things we were able to get done to move higher education forward. We also moved our graduation rate out of high school up to the top 10. We improved to the top 10 level. So we were, and by the time I was done as governor, we didn't have any of our schools that were on the unaccredited list anymore. So all of that was done in a very bipartisan way, and I think will stand the test of time as a good effort by folks to move the state's opportunities forward.
Governor Nixon, let me first give you a shout out on the education accomplishment, and that is extremely impressive. But one health policy challenge that I like to ask you about that I think you were unable to surmount, and I imagine this was a subject quite near and dear to your heart because it would have meant so much to so many of your residents, was the expansion of Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, which I think would have brought coverage and access to tens of thousands of your people. And as recently as last year, I understand there was an attempt to try and get Medicaid expansion through a ballot measure, but that effort was blocked. What did you learn from that experience in Missouri around being unable to get the Medicaid expansion through?
Well, it was disappointing. I mean, to have the federal dollars out there, to have the opportunity to affect communities, and we're seeing what happened because of that. We're having yet another rural hospital closing. We've seen health outcomes slip in our state. So what we did was, and I should also note that we didn't just sit on our hands when we couldn't get through the legislature. Yep. By working hard with our department, we were able to get 140,000 new kids covered by Medicaid by just getting out there and doing some good gumshoe work to make sure that every family that had a kid that was eligible got signed up. And that's a trend that has changed dramatically now with 60,000-70,000 fewer kids just in the last year on Medicaid in Missouri. You have to work at these things to make it happen. But it was a disappointment, and I think it's something that you try to get done. I think the politics of it got caught up, and I also think on both sides a little bit. But I think if there could have been just a little more flexibility sometimes in both sides of it, I think we might have been able to move forward. But the bottom line is that that law is still out there, and while the reimbursement numbers are dropping a little bit, I'm hopeful that in the future Missouri joins the number of states, Democrat and Republican governors and legislators, that are moving forward to expand Medicaid and make health care available for the working poor in Missouri and in America.
We're speaking today with former Missouri Governor Jay Nixon, who also served as the state's attorney general and as a state senator, where he focused in on environmental legislation. And Governor, I want to shift from health care to climate change. Obviously, we're just seeing such natural disasters accelerating in the country. And there's unfortunately seems to be a partisan disagreement over that threat as well. And you experienced unimaginable destruction with the level 5 tornado that struck Joplin, Missouri, which I believe sits in that tornado alley in 2011. Leaving many dead, thousands were injured, and created more debris than the fall of the Twin Towers. And I'm wondering, again, if you could share with our listeners what you learned from that disaster and the recovery, and how has it shaped your approach to this discussion that's going on around the country, but also around the globe?
It certainly was a chilling reminder of how as the planet changes and warms, the threat of these types of storms are going to increase. We've seen that. Science shows us that. And in that year, 2011, not only did we have that that EF5 in Joplin that killed 161 people and put 1,100 people in the hospital, wiped out 9 schools, 700 businesses, 7,600 houses, and almost 11,500 cars. The city of Joplin and the community rallied and built things back, and it's stronger today than it was before. So the first thing is while we'll get to the science part of this, but human nature is when you see that much effort and goodness, it's also inspirational. But that same year, we had floods in northwest Missouri that took out 65 levees. We had a tornado that hit the airport in St. Louis. We had a tornado that hit Sedalia, Missouri. We had the flooding of the Missouri River and Mississippi River that necessitated a decision I didn't agree with, but that necessitated the Corps of Engineers to blow up the levee in Bird Point and flood out a half a county. And that was also the year that we had to close I-70 one night because of over 30 inches of snow caused that highway had to be closed and plowed. And so, yes, I have seen that. Now, I also have a long history in this area. Back in the late 80s, I was on the first, what they called the Ozone Commission, that we established to begin the public policy issues around what was then seen as a hole in the ozone. It could cause problems. But I do believe that we as a people have to depoliticize science and have to depoliticize the discussions around climate change. If we don't, we will continue to see things get worse and not get better. And quite frankly, we're at a point now where in just a very few short years, it could be irreparable damage, especially when you talk about the levels of water that come and the types of tornadoes and cyclones that follow along the way. The bottom line is the science is in, and it's up to those folks that are in public service, not to scare people, but to educate people so that we can all work together for the strategies that can make the world safer and better in the long run.
Well, Governor, we certainly have vivid memories of that tornado and the destruction, and kudos to all the people of Missouri for the rebuilding efforts. But, there's another issue that's very much on the forefront, I would say, of our, to some degree, perhaps our policymakers in Washington, maybe more within the various bureaus that get the work done day to day, and that's the issue of rural health and access to health care in rural states and communities. Certainly the opioid use disorder crisis has made that obvious. The closing of rural hospitals, the difficulties recruiting people to come and practice as health care providers. What's your perspective, having been governor, of what's needed to really build rural health infrastructure? And does technology play a role in this? Were there innovation projects that you were particularly proud of or engaged with during your terms?
I think that technology does play a specific role because you've got to get people access to professionals, and sometimes the only way to do that is through distance communication of various sorts. Now, you obviously have tests and inpatient issues, but the bottom line is that easy access to health care is the best way to make sure that people live a healthy lifestyle, and if they do have problems, that they get to better outcomes. So we had a significant telehealth effort. It's called Mo Broadband Now, which was to hook up all of our hospitals, hook up all of our healthcare networks to telecommunication, the ability to not only just communicate by a screen, but also move tests around. But it's a long-term fight, especially as the population in some of these areas continues to have fewer folks. You're just not going to get the bricks and mortar investments that are necessary to move things forward. As far as the professionals, we had some success in a number of loan forgiveness programs, mm-hmm. in which we helped and expanded sponsoring doctors and other professionals. We also worked together in a bipartisan way to pass a measure that added about 1,700 healthcare professional degrees in Missouri. Just a quick little snippet. I mean, a friend of mine was involved with runs a large nursing home chain, and he had been in the Philippines. I said, "Why are you in the Philippines?" And he said, "Recruiting nurses." And it just always struck me that if we could make that gap and fill that gap by educating folks here, that we could fill those jobs at home, and that also means a healthier lifestyle. So I think it's important for people to remember that the healthcare area is one that you have not only doctors and nurses and dentists, but there are many other series of professionals that help people in the quality of their healthcare, from dietitians to mental health professionals to others. And if you can continue through your education system in those communities to empower and license folks, then you're going to have local people that are staying in their communities and you're getting better health outcomes. So I really do believe that technology and education are both tools that can level the playing field, hopefully, between the cities and in more rural areas. But we all got to admit that if you've got a really significant surgery, a heart transplant, a significant cancer surgery, that oftentimes you're going to have to go to the population centers, because that's the only place where you're going to have that high level of experience, expertise, and efficiency and safety of outcomes. So transportation is also important, being able to transport people from their community to experts that may be 10, 50, 100 miles away. That's part of the quality of rural health care.
You know, Governor Nixon, you're obviously a governor, and you come from a heartland state, and you've had to address a wide variety of issues of importance. You were just mentioning gun control, LGBT rights. We talked a little earlier about climate change and disaster recovery. And, you know, we've got all this coming up in the 2020 election cycle. And sort of there's going to be a conversation going on between politicians and the public. But I'm wondering, what's your prescription for how the public starts interacting with each other? What new compact do we need to start really addressing these issues that politicians need some consensus on? But it seems like there's more division than there is unity in this area.
It seems like we've always almost slipped over to politics and governing being a contest as opposed to a civic responsibility. I know when Sandra Day O'Connor retired from the Supreme Court, one of the things she's been working on is civics education. I was co-chair for a while of the National Civics Education with Governor Ducey in Arizona to make sure that people understand. We passed a measure here in Missouri that says that you got to pass a citizenship test by your senior year of high school.
Oh,
I think
great.
Giving people deeper understanding of how the levers of power can deliver for them. I mean, I think one of the real things that folks are kind of scared to get into politics, into public service, they're scared to go meet with their legislators sometimes. I think some of the best things that happened were individual citizens feeling empowered.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not about protest, it's about progress. If you see things that need to be solved, we need to empower people to feel like they can speak out and reach out. And right now, when you nationalize political coverage, which is basically what we've done in this country, when you nationalize news, which we're moving to with the closing of many small-town newspapers, small radio stations and others, and replacing those I don't mean to say negative things about any particular brand, but whether it's Sirius Radio or, you know, whatever national TV it is, it begins to lose the touch at the local community. So I think one other thing that folks need to do is reinvigorate some of that local media. And I'm not going to say we all have to go back to Benjamin Franklin's day and set type and deliver newspapers to everybody's front door, although Georgiana and I get a lot of newspapers. I'm still one of the Luddites that actually reads newspapers. But I do think that to put it in a flip way, I mean, Tip O'Neill wasn't wrong when he said all politics is local. That's mm-hmm. also true about policy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think right now empowering people to get involved, not just negatively, not just because they're upset with something, but because they should have a higher expectation, is important. And I will tell you that if I was looking for positive, it'd be that when I was in college, if I was doing a report, I had to go to the library, look up a book, and go to the Dewey Decimal System, figure out where I was in the library, walk up into the library, get that book, and guess what? If somebody else had already checked it out,
right,
I had to bring back a piece of wood and give it to the librarian, and they would tell me in 2 days the book would be back, and I'd go to my professor, and they would give me 2 extra days to do the report. That's not the way it is for these kids now. They have the whole world on their phone. So the bottom line is that information is available to folks, and I'm a big believer that we're in a transitional time, which we're going to move away from just communicating by tweet or Instagram, and we're actually going to start having discussions. But that only happens if we respect other people, if we embrace diversity, if we embrace people's differences. And I do think, I'm very optimistic that the younger people of this, at least of this country and this state, are more willing to embrace diversity, more willing to listen to other people than I think some of the politicians are. And I think that's a good sign for long run.
Well, that is a good note to end on. We've been speaking today with former Missouri Governor Jay Nixon, now a visiting senior fellow at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. You can learn more about his work and follow him on Twitter at @GovJNixon. Governor, we want to thank you for your leadership, your lifelong commitment to public service, and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you very much. It's been very, very productive to be here with you today, and I thank you very much for having me on.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
In the past 4 months, 5 states have passed laws that ban abortion once a heartbeat becomes detectable during a pregnancy. That prompted a reader to ask us, when do doctors hear a heartbeat during pregnancy, and when is the human heart fully developed? The short answer is that a developing heart has all of its primary structures after about 9 weeks of pregnancy. Some forms of ultrasound can detect cardiac activity in an embryo in the sixth week, but a heartbeat wouldn't be audible until about 10 weeks on a Doppler fetal monitor. Since cardiac activity can be detected in the sixth week of gestation or the fourth week after conception, abortion rights advocates such as Planned Parenthood refer to these state measures as six-week abortion bans. Others, including proponents, call them heartbeat or sometimes fetal heartbeat legislation. All of the state laws allow abortion if the pregnant woman's life or physical health is severely endangered, and some make exceptions for fatal chromosomal anomalies in the fetus or in cases of rape or incest. None of the laws are currently in effect, and some have been blocked in court. To research this question on when a heartbeat is detectable, we consulted multiple scientific reviews and spoke with experts on heart development and maternal fetal medicine. Heart development occurs over a four-week period starting in the sixth week of pregnancy. Based on 3D imaging of human embryos, scientists are able to identify all of the major structures after 9 weeks and 1 day of pregnancy, when the entire process is largely complete. Some development, such as changes to the cardiac muscle, continue into the second trimester. Heartbeats are first detectable with a transvaginal ultrasound, usually after 6 completed weeks of pregnancy, but also sometimes during the sixth week. The real-time scan, however, doesn't produce an audible heartbeat. It's visual only, showing a flicker, the slight movement of the developing heart while it beats. What most parents experience as the first audible heartbeat during pregnancy comes from a device known as a Doppler fetal monitor. The machine is handheld and also uses ultrasound waves. Technically, the heart sounds that the machine produces are not the actual sound of the fetus's heart beating. The sound is the amplified version of the difference between the transmitted and received signals. To hear a true heartbeat, expecting parents can turn to a stethoscope, which picks up fetal heartbeats after 20 to 22 weeks. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org.
Factcheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. It's a known fact that the current generation of American children is more obese than any previous generation. And at a Washington, D.C. community health center, Unity Healthcare, a pediatrician was in a quandary over how to tackle this growing health scourge. He began with a unique solution targeted to a teen patient whose body mass index, or BMI, had already landed her in the obese category. What he did was write a prescription for getting off the bus one stop earlier on her way to school, which made her walk the equivalent of 1 mile a day. Dr. Robert Czar of Unity Community Health Center understood that without motivation to move more, kids just might not do it. The patient complied with the prescription and has moved from the obese down to the overweight category, certainly an improvement. He then decided to expand this program by working with the D.C. Parks Department, mapping out all the potential walks and play area kids have within the city's parks, mapping 380 of them so far.
How to get there, parking, is parking available if someone's going to drive, bike racks, there's a section on pets. Park safety.
Dr. Czar writes park prescriptions on a special prescription pad in English and Spanish with the words RX for outdoor activity and a schedule slot that asks, when and where will you play outside this week?
I like to listen and find out what it is my patients like to do and then gauge the parks I prescribe based on their interests, based on their schedule, based on the things they're willing to do.
Ultimately, Dr. Czar says, with some 40% of his patient population grappling with overweight or obesity, he wants to make the prescription for outdoor activity adaptable for all of his patients and adaptable for pediatricians around the country. He's planning to create an app for his parks database where providers and patients alike can use it, and one day he'd like to be able to track his patients' activities in the parks. RX for outdoor activity, partnering clinicians, park administrators, patients, and their families to move more, yielding fitter, healthier young people. Now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.